program contains archived content. Some of the information may now be out of date.
Trump, if you want to stop immigration, like, don't say that we should cut money for border security and policing in Honduras. I mean, like, Bolli even endorsed that. U.S. funded the Honduran Border Patrol that hunts down people in the woods trying to flee their own country. I mean, that's what's going on with the dogs. And you can see that in the pictures on the Honduran paper of, like, dogs having trapped these women and children. So I wish I could say there's, like, a happy future, but this extractive model at the point of a gun and people aren't allowed to leave. I mean, I think people would not even be paying attention to this if people hadn't gotten out of the country and arrived at our border and somebody decided to call that a crisis.
That's Dana Frank, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Dana Frank on Honduras, coups, crises, and caravans. Honduras is one of the poorest countries in Latin America and has one of the world's highest murder rates. More than half of its population of about 10 million live in poverty, and per capita income is one of the lowest in the region. Since the June 2009 coup overthrowing the government of President Manuel Zelaya, the country has been ruled by repressive regimes. Washington, under Obama and Hillary Clinton, backed the coup. Today, oligarchic rule pauperizes the people. Corruption is rampant. Violence is widespread. Criminals literally get away with murder. Some Hondurans, seeking a better and safer future for themselves and their families, join the caravans heading north to the U.S. border. The journey is fraught with peril. Their chances of getting asylum are slim. Others remain behind and resist the tyranny. Our guest today is Dana Frank. She's professor of history emerita at the University of California at Santa Cruz. She's the author of The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and U.S. Policy in the Aftermath of the Coup. Her articles about human rights and U.S. policy in Honduras have appeared in The Nation, The New York Times, The Miami Herald, and many other publications. She has testified before both the U.S. Congress and the Canadian Parliament. She spoke at the University of Denver. And now, Dana Frank.
When I talk about Honduras, I guess the biggest point I want to make is it's not just what I've come to call, from my own point of view, the river of horror. Because it is a river of horror with endless dead bodies and repression and state-sponsored terror. But it's also, there's another story there that is balanced by incredibly beautiful activism, hope, and joy and struggle in daily life, and people expressing all kinds of alternatives for how they would like to manage their society. And so much of the coverage of Honduras is in the last few years is Hondurans as suffering victims. And the classic is, here's the mother in the morgue in San Pedro Sula sobbing over her son's dead body with a sense of powerlessness and no hope. And the Washington Post actually had a subtitle to some photographs which said that, with complete powerlessness, precisely at the moment when this particular spread came out, when the opposition party had potentially won the presidency in 2013, certainly had gone from zero to the second largest party in Congress at that point, the new center-left party, Libre. There was activism of every kind going on around that morgue that disappears from that neighborhood of just the terror, which doesn't mean it's not terrible that's what happened to that woman and her kids. Hondurans are not just suffering victims. They're people with great joy in life and resilience and vision. And even the caravan itself, you might see it as a victim story, but actually these people are choosing a strategy very consciously. Those caravans are full of political activists with a critique of their government. There are at least three former Congress members that have been in caravans in the last year. They're not just mindless people with no political analysis that haven't tried many, many different paths. When you hear, when you think about why are people fleeing Honduras, the great majority are fleeing gangs, violence, and poverty, as well as political repression. But what you don't hear is what is causing that proliferation of violence and poverty. Okay, you don't hear that these are political outcomes of political policies, especially in the U.S. as well as Honduras. So this is not a natural disaster. There's a long history of discussions in the United States by white people of people in Latin America as the notion that the little brown people, and this can apply to the Philippines, lots of places, that the little brown people cannot govern themselves, that it's sort of like they are incapable of governing themselves. That's why things get really bad down there, when actually it's more likely to be the outcome of U.S. policy in contradiction to their own notions of self-government. These people are in many ways refugees from U.S. policy. Okay, the U.N. certainly has called Honduran migrants refugees since the unaccompanied undocumented minors that came in 2014. You might remember that. And they are refugees in part from U.S. policy. So let me first talk about violence in the gangs, okay? I think you probably, I don't need to tell you how the gangs operate, how they force people into them, how the sexual violence against young women, the way they kill people all over the place, they kill each other, they kill their rivals, they kill people who won't cooperate with them. And those gangs originated in Los Angeles, and they were young people that were arrested and then treated with great repression in Los Angeles in the 80s and 90s, and then deported to El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, and they had learned really vicious things when they were in prison in Los Angeles. And then those gangs then spread in Central America. They were present in Honduras before the coup, but what the coup itself did was, the coup itself of 2009 was this huge criminal act, right? So it was a collusion between the Supreme Court, the majority of Congress, and the military to overthrow the government, and this post-coup de facto president Micheletti, Roberto Micheletti, took power, and the group of elites that own about 90% of the Honduran economy just ran roughshod over the entire society, and there were no brakes on this. And they, in that context, and they were already embedded with drug traffickers and organized crime, okay? So in that context, the rule of law disintegrated. And, you know, a lot of these concepts since the coup, like the rule of law, we now understand that they're precious here in the United States since Trump, right? The concept of constitutional order being disrupted or of the rule of law being overthrown. Well, it's like the rule of law almost doesn't exist in Honduras. But it means that corruption just swept through and upward through the police and the military and the judiciary and the Congress and the presidency. You can almost do anything you want and nothing will happen to you. The impunity rate has been around 93 to 95% for at least 7 or 8 years, which means you can kill anybody you want and nothing will happen to you. Now multiply that towards all kinds of other crimes. In that context in which the judiciary, the Attorney General's office, and then a great good part of the Congress are all corrupt, the gangs proliferated. So the gangs don't just happen to be strong in Honduras. The gangs actually don't proliferate in Nicaragua, for example, right? You don't hear of gangs in Nicaragua, which had a different policing system. I'm not defending the government now in Nicaragua, but in these years, the gangs did not proliferate in Nicaragua, which had different policing systems. So it's really important to see that it was a coup that opened the door to the gangs, and the gangs kill people. They also, they're tied in with the police, because it's also been highly documented since 2011 that the Honduran police are overwhelmingly corrupt. The government keeps creating police reform commissions that then announce the police have been corrupt, and then those people commit crimes, or the new ones do, or the people at the top are never actually cleaned up. In 2012, it was revealed that the new national director of the police, El Tigre Bonilla, who had been brought in to clean up the police, was himself a documented death squad leader from 2003. And the U.S. supported him for 2 years until he finally was kicked out in 2013. So the police are very much interlocked with the gangs. Since around 2013-14, the gangs have moved into extortion of small businesses and bus drivers and cab drivers. And a lot of the people you see getting killed are people that won't pay their so-called taxes to the gang extortionists. And watch, if you watch the Honduran papers, you'll see how many cab drivers and bus drivers are getting killed as we speak. And I know a lot of people in the small business community in Honduras, in a particular suburb of San Pedro Sula, and the people in like a 4 or 5 block area, and they were very good friends with the barber 2 blocks away, and a man in his 30s, and the gangs came around and said, you have to pay X every week, and this woman will come on Tuesday and collect. And he paid, and then he filed a police report. And 2 weeks later, he was killed. And it was he and his assistant, and it was all caught on a video camera. And nothing ever happened for years to the people who had killed them that were walking around town. Everybody knew who it was. A year later, old man, and there's several stories like this. A street had a CD store, little tiny store. And when the woman came around after this, they'd been collecting money from him for a year and a half, he put his hand on her arm and said, "I'm really tired of this. I'm an old man. I'm sick." Meanwhile, the police and the military had been patrolling the streets to protect people against the gangs for 9 months since the barber was killed. And they disappeared from the streets for 48 hours. Somebody came and killed the old man, and then the next day they returned back into the streets. So these are just two tiny examples of the collusion between the police and the military. The National Minister of Security, like a cabinet officer, oversees the police, Julian Pacheco Tinoco, former general. He has twice been named in U.S. federal court as overseeing drug trafficking flights. The new national director of the police that was appointed in January, and the number two and number three were documented by the Associated Press a year ago to be have overseen cocaine trafficking. So there's drug traffickers and criminals at the very, very, very top. So it's not like a few bad apples down here that need to be cleaned up. Most recently, you may have seen that the president's brother, Tony Hernandez, who was a congressman, is now in jail in the United States, and this is Southern District of New York, for drug trafficking and moving arms. And he was a major, major drug trafficking leader in Honduras. In fact, some people, there's been a lot, 9 or 10 massacres of young people and in the cities in the last, just since the first of the year. And a lot of people are saying it's because the different powers are duking it out because Tony has picked off. Okay, this is what happens in Mexico. You arrest one narco or you put him in jail or they get killed, and then everybody, more violence happens as the powers duke it out after that. And this is the brother of the president. Nobody I know believes that the president could have not known what his brother was doing. There's someone who has testified that the president himself is also involved in drug trafficking. The other big source of violence is domestic violence, called feminicides, in Latin America. And the domestic violence has skyrocketed. So you can kill someone and nothing will happen to you. But also you kill somebody in a bar fight. It's not just men. Obviously, men are dying too. But the domestic violence side of this is really serious. And there's a lot, if you're interested in a research topic, there's a lot about this. So that's the first piece of this. Where is the violence coming from? And if you listen to the people's stories, almost any interview from somebody in a caravan will say, "We were fleeing the gangs." Many will say, "We're fleeing the police." And I get asked once a week to be an expert witness in an asylum case, and so many of them are about the police, as well as the gangs, or the police and the gangs together. And you see it over and over and over again. So the other big piece of why people are leaving is poverty. Honduras never had a golden age before the coup. It's never had a middle class that was like more than 4 or 5% for complicated historic reasons. But it had a functioning economy before the coup, and it also had rule of law that protected investment climates, right? So one basic thing that's happened is outsiders don't want to invest because they can't guarantee that they will be able to even get into their bank accounts, or that that anything legal will happen. They have to have a legal structure to have an outside investment. There's so much corruption and so much is just stolen by the Honduran elites once any money comes into the country that you have this plummeting outside investment, although they're still in there. But more importantly, you have a sort of systematic destruction of livelihoods. And I'm saying livelihoods because it's not just jobs. It's a lot of ways in which people have had economic lives. And many of this is the sectors that you hear of as development. What gets celebrated as the key sectors of economic development are also huge engines of pushing people off their land and creating poverty. The most famous of these is palm oil. And palm oil is a huge issue all over the world, in many parts of the world. Indonesia is a big example of that. In Honduras, it has a murderous history. There are these campesino collectives in an area called the Awan Valley, and they were settled by agrarian reform by the government in the 1970s and 80s, and they were successful. Small farmers or peasants, successful cooperatives. And when neoliberal governments came in the 90s and early 2000s, they reversed the policy and made it so that big landowners could force people off those lands or privatize them, but also the using corrupt land issues in the courts forced people off the land. And the biggest culprit here was a man named Miguel Facuse, who was the richest person in the country. He just died a couple years ago, and his family, the Dinant Corporation, continues this. And so thousands of small farmers, collectives, were driven off their land. After, and they had been negotiating with the government, with Celaya at the time of the coup, to have some redress. And once the coup happened, all bets were off for that. So these campesinos started reoccupying their lands. This is a long Latin American tradition. And also under Honduran agrarian reform law, they have the right to occupy unsettled lands or government lands that are not being used, and then after they occupy it, to petition for legal ownership. Okay, that's a legal thing people can do. So people start reoccupying their lands and that they had legally owned, and Facusei, allegedly, he had a private army of 200 security guards and alleged assassins working with police and the military, killed people. Campesino activism, they're still killing them one by one, two by two, at least 150 people in a slow-moving massacre in the next four years, and people are still being killed and driven off their lands with complete impunity. Maybe in one case has someone ever gone to jail for all these killings, despite all the witnesses. Palm oil itself employs very few workers. It's extremely destructive of the environment for many reasons, one of which is it sucks all the water out of the land, destroying the water table for other farmers after that. Another sector is tourism, and tourism in Honduras, a lot of it happens, or people want to have it happen, along the Caribbean coast, is owned traditionally by the Garifuna, Afro-indigenous people who settled there in the 18th century when they were driven off their lands on the island of St. Vincent. And they have lived there for centuries, and they have Afro-indigenous land rights and fishing villages along there. And that's the territory that people, elites and outside investors, want for big hotel and tourist developments. And they were not going to get hired in those places, I'll tell you. And so their livelihoods as fisher people are being destroyed. And also some of their land has been taken over or tried to be taken over for palm oil plantations as well. Most famously, hydroelectric dams. And how many of you heard of Berta Cáceres? Some of you. Berta Cáceres was a very famous Honduran indigenous feminist resistance activist, leader of the Lenca people. And she and her people were fighting against a major hydroelectric dam along the Gualcarque River. They had rights as indigenous people that traditionally had been on those lands, and the dam is destroying that environment of that whole region. So they started peacefully protesting for many years. Berta, the leader, got at least 33 death threats that were never investigated by the government, and she was assassinated on March 2nd. 3 years ago. She had gotten the Goldman Environmental Prize. Pelosi had had a reception in her honor in Congress. She'd met with the Pope. We did everything we can to keep her alive. And when they killed her, it was like saying they would kill anybody. And seven men have been convicted of killing her. We're the ones that did it, but the people who called the killing, the elites that own the dam allegedly, have still not been charged. And one of those people that killed her was the head of military intelligence at the time. So Berta's case, it also shows just an example of these dams that are going in all over, and then people are resisting them and getting killed for it. The other sector is mining. About a third of all the Honduran territory has been granted mining rights and concessions, right? That happened within 2 years after the coup. And so there's all these mining projects that are forcing people off their lands, farmers, indigenous people, all kinds of people, and then displacing them into urban areas. And then from those urban areas, they realize they're starving to death or going to get killed by the gangs and migrate north. The big sort of piece of the formal economy is the maquiladora sector, which is apparel, export processing apparel factories. They employ about 140,000 people. That's overwhelmingly young people. They work 12 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week. Hideous conditions, 100 degrees, humid, no air conditioning. They breathe cotton dust. They go blind for the sewing machines. And that sector is very destructive of young people's bodies. And in the last few years, Honduras has good labor laws, and they're just not being enforced, period. And this is a violation of the labor side agreements under the Central American Free Trade Agreement. AFL-CIO has been involved about this. But if you don't have labor law enforcement, that means people just routinely just don't get paid. The money isn't paid into the National Health Service. Their money isn't paid into their pensions, anything in the formal economy. There's no enforcement if you don't have labor law enforcement, which is something we fight for here. Finally, I'll just talk about the state sector. Because Honduras did have a functioning state at the time of the coup, and this is where the corruption is just top to bottom. Immediately, in the first 6 months after the coup, the teachers' unions were very strong in Honduras at the time of the coup. And the entire pension fund of the teachers for Honduras was robbed in 6 months. Okay, just disappeared, right? And the people that ran the coup just took the money. But now there's just all kinds of corruption cases coming out where there will be some NGO that gets created and government money goes in to pay the NGO, and then the money goes out of the NGO into the pockets of the elites. And that's happening like agency after agency after agency. Also, deliberate policies have destroyed state jobs. And what's happened since the 90s, but most dramatically since the coup, is austerity programs from the International Monetary Fund and other multilateral development things. They say, okay, we'll give you money short to, so your government doesn't go bankrupt, but in exchange for that, you have to privatize and sell things off. They're starting to sell off the ports, the state-owned telephone company, the electrical company, and that has just destroyed good union jobs. But just whole agencies get eliminated, and you've seen the paper, 8,000 people, good union jobs, just lost their jobs. Okay, and this has been going on for years now. Very deliberate policy by the IMF. The executive committee at IMF, they said, we're helping the Honduran government lower their wage bill. Like, either you're paying people a lot less or you're getting rid of little jobs. Most recently, I just looked it up recently, and they said, we're helping them right-size their wage bill. They don't want to admit the IMF is lowering wages in Honduras. So this also not only means the destruction of jobs working for the government, but it means government services get gutted, okay? When you're poor, this is huge. The most famous case was in 2015 when a man named David Romero, a journalist, revealed checks that showed that the president and his party, for the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, when he first ran in 2013, stole as many as $90 million from the National Health Service to pay for their campaigns in 2013. I'm not making this up. The attorney general admitted the checks were real. Now, other money was stolen from the National Health Service for bogus ambulance bills and medication bills that there weren't actual medication at all. At least 3,000 people died just in that first year because the National Health Service went bankrupt. There still aren't dialysis machines. Doctors and nurses don't get paid. And it was this huge scandal that the Attorney General admitted the evidence was real. And nobody's ever been prosecuted at the top level of the government. And that's the most obvious example of mind-boggling corruption that people have died from. So I'll just end that by saying you can say they're fleeing violence and poverty, but it's not a natural disaster. The Honduran state and the elite actors have created this vortex of violence and poverty very deliberately, but also by looking at the other ways, and the corruption of the security forces. So let me just talk about U.S. policy then, and then we'll talk about resistance to this. U.S., I think some of you know this, that U.S., we don't have a smoking gun that said the U.S. said, yes, you can have a coup. Like, even the way you can see what's going on in Venezuela right now, in lifetime. Now, I'm not going to defend the government of Maduro, but the U.S. is, and I don't want to be on Venezuela, but the U.S. is in fact enacting and supporting a coup in Venezuela right now. You can also see a technical coup going on in Guatemala right now, when the Jimmy Morales is taking over the Supreme Court and kicking out the Commission on Impunity. So we're seeing a lot of these scary things playing out with more or less transparency right now. We do know that the plane that carried Zelaya out of the country stopped at Sotocano Air Force Base, which is a U.S. Honduran joint Air Force Base. No one thinks they would have been allowed to do that without U.S. permission. You know, then Obama says, oh, it's an illegal coup the next day. And then he remained silent after that. He handed over to Hillary Clinton, who refused to call it a military coup. She decided to make this distinction, whereas the law says if it's significant military involvement, all the money has to be suspended immediately. It was $300 million. And she would never do that. She would never use the phrase military coup. But more importantly, what the U.S. did is they treated the post-coup dictator, de facto President Micheletti, as an equal to Zelaya in negotiations. So rather than saying, no matter what happens, Zelaya has to be restored, they said, well, we're having negotiations. And there had been negotiations initially within the Organization of American States, the OAS, that the U.S. didn't control at that time. The U.S. moved the negotiations to Costa Rica, controlled them, and then kept treating those two as equals. A deal is struck where Zelaya was supposed to get to come back in exchange for Micheletti pulling out when the regular elections happened, and that never happened. And then what they did was they played out time. The U.S. played out time until November. So this is 5 months after the coup, when there were regularly scheduled elections that were supposed to happen. Okay, in those elections, none of the opposition, all the left opposition candidates had all pulled out. The party that the traditional conservative party that Zelaya, the deposed president, came from, and the coup leader, that had crumbled because Zelaya people were all in opposition, and the Micheletti people were clearly coup perpetrators. That left the only man standing was the rather right wing party, the National Party, and also you couldn't even get the army controlled the ballots. The army controlled the streets. There was an opposition presidential candidate whose arm was broken by the military very deliberately during a demonstration, or military or the police, Carlos H. Reyes. And so it was very clear you couldn't have a free and fair election. No international observers would observe it except the U.S. Republican Party. And the U.S. recognized Porfirio Lobo, the outcome of the election. If you look in the Hillary Clinton WikiLeaks emails, the most interesting thing there is not, you can see this whole playing out, which we could see in the time, but you can see them talking about how they're going to do it. The most interesting email is from a guy named Thomas Shannon, you probably haven't heard of, but has been the architect of U.S. policy in Latin America since the coup until things moved so far to the right that he was forced out a year ago. But he stayed into the Trump administration, and he was from Bush administration. There's an email the morning or the night before the elections, that November 2009 elections, when he says, I think the best path, he's writing to Hillary, the best path is to say it's a beautiful example of democracy in action or something like that. And sure enough, the next day she says, the Honduran people are continuing their democratic vocation and this beautiful example of democracy in action or something like that. And it's like, okay, so it was clear that the U.S. was going to green light and support the permanency of the post-coup regime. And Lobo would continue to unleash tremendous repression against the opposition and pass all kinds of scary laws I don't have time to go into. His successor is a man named Juan Orlando Hernandez, who's the president now, okay? And I would call him a dictator. The Honduran calls him a dictator. You'll see why. He's the brother of the one that was the arrested narco, okay? So there's Juan Orlando Hernandez, and I'll call him Juan Orlando. That's his first name. So Juan Orlando Hernandez was a member of Congress at the time of the coup. He was a part of a congressional committee that supported the coup, the legal coup. When he was president of Congress in 2012, he led something called the technical coup, when in the middle of the night, they deposed 4 out of 5 members of the constitutional part of the Supreme Court and named new supporting court justices the next day, completely illegally, okay? You can't do that, just like here, right? Just like here so far. So, and that's the equivalent of our Supreme Court. The other parts are like appeals courts. That's the so-called technical coup of 2012, at which point it was clear that he was taking power. He ran for president in 2013 in a campaign of a soldier on every corner, and that the sending in the military, he's very tied with the military and evangelicals, that the military would take over policing because the regular police are corrupt, and that's had lethal results. And, of course, the military are tied in with drug traffickers. Okay, that's Juan Orlando in his first term. So in 2016, they're starting toward the primaries, and the Honduran Constitution says very clearly that no sitting president or vice president can run for re-election, and anybody who is even illegal to even advocate it while in office. Now, this is what had been used as a pretext for the coup against Zelaya, but he actually never, ever said that at the time. Okay, but that, ironically, this is what Juan Orlando actually did. So the Supreme Court that he had illegally imposed, right, in the technical coup, ruled that, oh, yeah, you can have re-election because the Constitution is bad because it violates international norms of human rights. Okay, like they have no more right than our Supreme Court does to say, oh no, Constitution is bad, doesn't apply. And this is not an ambiguous part of the Constitution. So that was the green light, and the U.S. blessed it and said, oh, it's up to Hondurans to decide how they want to interpret their laws, which was an official statement, and that gave the green light for Juan Orlando to run for re-election illegally. So the opposition, the new opposition party, I'll talk about that, Libre, and a sort of nutcase sportcaster, center-right figure named Salvador Nasralla, united as an opposition against Juan Orlando. And the election was a year ago, November. Okay, so, and the night of the election results came in very dramatically with 57% of the votes in, that Nasralla, the opposition candidate, was ahead by 8 or 9%. Now, that's after the government had manipulated and stolen votes and bought votes, all of which is documented. Okay, so that means that Nasralla not only had, like, maybe, I would guess, 60 or 70% of the actual real vote, but certainly the official count, he was ahead by 9% with 57 bumps. And people started going, like, oh, my God. And they said about 12 hours of hope. And then the government shut down all the computers and said, oh, computers aren't working. We don't have any more results. And over the course of the next week and a half, let out vote counts 5% at a time, vote totals, and lo and behold, Juan Orlando won by 1.5%. And it's very much understood that he stole the election. Luis Almagro, the head of the OAS, who is a complicated figure, even said that there should be a new election and that this was not a valid election. Okay, and the U.S. hemmed and hawed, and guess what, recognized Juan Orlando. So he's had this illegitimate presidency forever since.
You're listening to Dana Frank on Honduras, Coups, Crises, and Caravans. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
The U.S. has backed Juan Orlando and the POSCU government at every turn, not just with giving money, generous funding to Honduran security forces and to the government, but legitimation. The legitimation function is extremely important, signaling to other parts, to EU, to Canada, to the rest of the world, that this is a legitimate government, even celebrating. You guys know who John Kelly is, was until recently Trump's chief of staff. Before that, he was the head of the U.S. Southern Command in charge of Honduras for 3 years as Juan Orlando was first in power. And he gave multiple speeches in which he said Juan Orlando was doing a magnificent job or impressive job fighting drug trafficking and was a great friend of the United States. When Trump first came in, Kelly was head of Homeland Security. He said Juan Orlando was a great guy and a good friend. And then, of course, he became chief of staff, and he was the guy running the show of U.S. policy in Central America until recently. The current U.S. ambassador is an acting ambassador named Heidi Fulton, put out statements celebrating the close relationship and friendship between the United States and the government of Honduras. So it's not like it's back then, and it's not just Hillary, it's green light after green light after green light. It's very bright green down there. Why is the U.S. doing this? This is a $64,000 question that I spent years trying to understand. And a lot of people were blindsided by that. It was Obama. We had higher hopes for Obama initially. And it's really, the big punchline is geopolitical power. Okay, so the U.S. has tried to control Latin America famously since the 19th century, the Monroe Doctrine. It sees it as its own in an offensive metaphor of backyard that it has the right to control. Long, long history of dancing with dictators in Latin America that is once again now taking off even more as we speak. And the U.S. will work with just about anybody in order to keep its own geopolitical interests in there. There's also just the generic process of wanting to support governments that are going to be supportive to transnational corporations and their environmental destruction and labor exploitation. It's not so simple in Honduras as it used to be, or in Guatemala in the 50s and 60s, where United Fruit controls the State Department and it's all about protecting United Fruit. There are Chiquita and Dole in there. They're minor players in this. And you can see Canada more clearly. The mining companies have come from Canada, and also Gildan, depending on how you pronounce it, the textile company from Canada. There's the maquiladora sector. That stuff is sold in the United States. The other thing is the military, which has taken me a long time to figure all this out. The military is an engine that runs of itself. The military likes to have power just to have power. And so they have to be down there, even though they know all about drug trafficking, they need a reason to be down there. And so the military's drug war is why they have to be down there, because otherwise, where's the threat? Okay? Of course, now it's 5,000 starving victims of all this trying to cross the border with asylum cases. But what would be the threat for U.S. military presence in Central America, right? And so Kelly even has said some things like, in present some people, some I know, first he made a public statement saying, you remember Ebola, you know, the disease in Africa? He said, well, if Ebola gets to Central America and they start moving north, it'll be Katie bar the barn door, meaning, God, we're going to have to wall off our border. This is 3 years ago, because there's going to be this invasion of poisonous Central Americans carrying disease, right? And he later admitted in front of two people I know in Washington that he had only said that in part to get more money to the Southern Command, right? So this is what I mean by that. That's when I could really see the engine running of itself. And so I'll come back to Trump at the end here. Let me just end by talking about resistance in Honduras and here. Another piece, the last piece of media coverage of this is the suffering victim things, is it erases the long history of activism and successful mass activism in Honduras since the coup. Who, first of all, at the time of the coup, the National Front of Popular Resistance, which came seemingly out of nowhere, but built on social movements that had been little by little building in the LGBT movement, the women's movement, the campesino movement, indigenous movements in particular, in the years before the coup, that came together immediately at the time of the coup in this huge coalition with the human rights community, with the labor movement, with more formal, with the Jesuits, all kinds of folks, and faith-based groups into this huge coalition, the National Front of Popular Resistance, that was very, very powerful. Huge demonstrations, the teachers' unions, huge demonstrations in the streets for 2 years, and thousands of people were killed and repressed and jailed and beaten up, you name it, tear gassed. But it was this amazing coalition, especially the inclusion of the LGBT movement. And you hear these old charged union Marxist Leninists saying, El movimiento gay, you know, that was a completely new thing. And the culture really changed from below. Like, young people are singing songs of resistance, and there's this great graffiti. And I mean, my favorite graffiti is about the cardinal, who's this corrupt cardinal that blessed the coup on the sixth day. And there's progressive Catholics that are in the resistance. And they said, Nadie ama al Cristo como el cardinal ama al pisto, which means nobody loves Christ like the cardinal loves cash. I mean, just like great stuff, like all over the place. And young people like sitting up straight and a whole sense of cultural pride that Hondurans had not had. They would be the first to say that during the 80s and 90s, they were kind of like the armpit of social movements in Central America, right? They were not the ones that had the armed struggle and political parties. They never had a center-left party or political party in all Honduran history that had more than 1% of the vote or 2% of the vote until this period. In 2011, the resistance split into sort of two camps. One was the social movement side of it, and the other was the ones that wanted to form a political party. And a big chunk of the resistance was always middle-class people or people that were part of the Liberal Party, the traditional Liberal Party, that had been following Zelaya, okay, and supported that. And a lot of people, other people, didn't think that Honduras was ready for to go into a new opposition political party because the opportunities for corruption and patronage were too great. And they needed to build their base from below more slowly. But one part, led by Zelaya, formed a new political party called Libertad y Refundación. And his wife, Xiomara Castro, ran for president in 2013, may have probably won the presidency. She was ahead in all but one of the polls, but Juan Orlando Hernandez won in 2013. But Libre became from zero to the second largest party in Congress, but they couldn't get a majority, and the Liberal Party, the other right-wing party, then ruled along with a majority. The third moment of mass protest was in 2015, when the news came out that the president and his campaign had stolen all that money, bankrupting the National Health Service. Middle-class people erupted in these huge, huge protests. They're almost as big as the ones right after the coup, in the so-called indignados movement, which means the outraged ones. And they carried torches to represent all the people that had died, and the demonstrations happened at twilight. And I saw the two biggest ones. They carry these torches, like tiki torches, you know, you'd have in your luau and in your backyard, and they, for one, for everybody who had died. And you could, there's a bridge over the boulevard in the middle of the Capitol, and you could see in the dark torches, thousands. It was about 75,000 people, as far as you could see in every direction, carrying these torches. And these were people who had not demonstrated before. There was a lot of media about them. Some of these people had supported the coup, but they had enough. And that they demanded a UN commission on corruption and impunity, like the one that's being driven out of Guatemala right now. And instead, the U.S. undermined that demand. They demand that Juan Orlando resign, and the Attorney General resign, and both of those people are still in place. You never know any of this today, even though these things were in the New York Times at the time. They've disappeared from our narrative of who the Honduran people are. Three former Congress members have been in Congress. The caravan that left last spring, they were carrying signs when they crossed into Guatemala and Mexico that said Fuera Jo, which means Juan Orlando Hernandez out, right? His initials are J-O-H. I mean, they have very clearly come out of these traditions that I'm talking about here, and all that disappears, that people actually have notions of how they'd like to organize society, but they don't have access to free and fair elections that they would want. And that's, there's a whole convergence going on right now of all these social movements to demand a new election and that Juan Orlando resign. Let me just end by saying one thing really quick about Congress. There are many of us who have tracked this for many years, and there's been a largely invisible solidarity movement going on in the United States of long history of opposition to U.S. policy. That's something else that is not in the news. You would not. How many of you know that 71 members of Congress have signed the Bertha Cáceres Human Rights Act that calls for a suspension of U.S. police and military aid. 71 members of the House. In 2013, 21 senators signed a letter questioning U.S. security funding for Honduras. Now, that was 114th Congress. It's about to be reintroduced, right? So we have to get back up to that even higher. Very interesting, both good and bad things happening in the House now. But how did that disappear? At one point in 2013, 94 members of the House signed a letter led by Janice Schakowsky calling for a suspension of police and military aid to Honduras. And the Berta Cáceres Act also calls for a U.S. to vote no on all multilateral development bank loans. There's U.S. money flowing in, but the really big bucks flows in through the IMF, the World Bank, and the IDB. And also, since 2012, the State and Foreign Operations Budget, the Act, has had, which funds part of the money for the Honduran Security Forces, also USAID and the State Department, it has had conditions, human rights conditions, on aid to Honduras, 20% starting in 2012, 50% starting in 2017. There's also, starting in 2017, Republican conditions saying they have to try to stop immigration. But the 50% on them, all the money to the central government can't be released until the State Department certifies that they have met human rights conditions, stopped, fought corruption, taken the military out of policing, and several other things. Every year, the State Department certifies that those conditions had met, despite vast evidence to the contrary. 2017, the year before last, they certified 3 days after the election, right as the election was being stolen, they certified that the human rights conditions had been met. Interestingly, they have still not certified for 2018. And then certain senators have can put money on hold and not release that. So especially Senator Patrick Leahy, who's the ranking Democrat on Appropriations, has been heroic. And often, sometimes, and we never know about it, it's not in the paper, he doesn't even talk about it, will hold money back and use that as leverage to try to, for example, get the Honduran government to prosecute in Berta Cáceres' case, right? So that's a very complicated policy tool. Some people will say, give them even more money so you can have even more conditions, so you can have more leverage. We say, are you kidding? Just don't give them the money. Why are you giving the money? Why would you give our tax money? Where are we at right now with Trump? I think most of you probably know that Trump, when the caravans began, and he started saying this last spring, which first of all, saying that the caravans are a crisis, you know, that like these starving people, terrorized people arriving the border are a threat to the United States, when of course there are much, much greater threats to the United States. And these are refugees, including from U.S. policy. But that he said, well, he's punishing, cut all the aid. So we're like, oh my God, how do we say cut the aid if Trump is saying cut the aid? Which has made it a little complicated, right? And he does it in a punishing way to the Honduran government, right? And he's been doing it again fairly recently. One notch down from him, though, Senator Rubio, who is running the show, U.S. policy in Latin America right now, there have been articles about him in Venezuela, and he is the one that is sort of advising Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and Bolton, the National Security Director, and they're very ideological. And if you're either with the U.S. or you're not, you're either left or you're not. And it's a very much a geopolitical thing also about who's going to line up with the U.S. But Rubio actually wants the money to flow. He actually tweeted against Trump in October saying, no, don't cut the money, which means they shows you they want that money to flow to keep the stable government of Juan Orlando Hernandez, right? So what's going on now is very interesting because on the one hand, the Berta Cáceres Act is going to be introduced, but there's a centrist position, which is, and Rubio is part of this, but you can see it cross over, which is things are terrible down there. We need economic development. And of course, they do. So give them even more money or don't cut the money, right? Now, that's why it's really important, the analysis I did of the economic development model. There's something called the Alliance for Prosperity in the Northern Triangle, which both Biden Obama pushed when the unaccompanied minors arrived in 2014. But if you actually look at it, it's all going into the same elites and same sectors that are destroying livelihoods. So yes, we want economic development, but in a way that doesn't destroy livelihoods, but also isn't what the United States decides should look like for an interest of U.S. elites, right? It's like, could we let the Honduras have democracy so they themselves could decide what money they want and what do they spend it on? They have wonderful ideas for what economic development would look like, including agrarian reform, which has been very successful in Latin American history. And so I'll just end there, and we'll see what your comments and questions are. Thanks. So So was the Honduras the first model for this new, with the coup, for this new kind of rising of a government that they, is testing what they can get away with as they steal things and force people? Did they, is that right? Okay. Honduras was, in fact, the base for the U.S. invasion of Guatemala in 1954, although that happened in the middle of a general strike in which the entire Honduran economy was shut down for 2 months. I bet you didn't know that. The other most famous moment in Honduran history. Also, Honduras was known as the USS Honduras, was the base for the war, the Contra War against the Sandinistas, bloody war run by the United States against the Sandinistas in the 1980s. And that's when death squads were preponderating and killing leftists. And John Negroponte, who's still out there advising Trump, advising Biden, was the U.S. ambassador at the time and knew all about it and didn't stop it. And these people are still out there. So... And Honduras was always sort of been the most captive nation of the United States. And that's important for its whole history. What happens is the democracy comes to Latin America, to most countries, in the 90s, and the military governments are thrown out, and democracy comes, and people elect center and center-left governments. And there's also some constitutional new constitutions. So suddenly in Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, Bolivia, Venezuela... Eventually, El Salvador, already in place, Nicaragua. All of this is happening, and Zelaya is the weakest link in all that. Zelaya is not a leftist. He's not come from the social movements. He comes from the elites, but he's stopping privatizations. He raised the minimum wage, and he allied with ALBA and these alliances and threatened U.S. oil sales, too, but for that matter. So he was the weakest link in all that lineup that the U.S., when Obama came in, it was like, whoa, they started rethinking U.S. policy and realized the U.S. had lost Latin America, the way they used to talk about China, right? And so, like, what are they going to do? And Zelaya was the weakest link in that because he himself didn't have a popular base. So you had the sense. You also, another important thing for the U.S. is Soto Cano Air Force Base, which is where they ran the Contra War. So the only place they can land the big planes between the U.S. and Colombia, especially after Correa kicked the U.S. base out of Ecuador, saying, yeah, you can have a base here in Ecuador as long as we can have a base in Miami. That was the best line out of Korea, who unfortunately got in West South ever since then. But, you know, so Zelaya was the first domino. That was the message. We'll do that to you. I mean, the U.S. had supported a coup attempt in Venezuela in a few years before that. Now what we're seeing now is the fruition of that with these ideological people in charge and doing everything King and Cam to have regime change in Nicaragua and in Venezuela, which I am not defending the governments of either of those countries, but look what happens when the U.S. brings in a new government. This is not what's going to be the happy ending here. And you can certainly see that very, very clearly in Honduras. And no matter what they do, the U.S. will back them. Oh, the question is, what do you see as the future for Honduras? I don't think things swing naturally back and forth. I think people build things from below, and repression comes from usually above, but also from below. So I'm a historian by trade, so I think that people always rise up, and they always fight oppression, and they will. And they do all day, every day in Honduras now. In invisible ways. I mean, about 4 years ago, I gave a talk, maybe, and people said, what do you think if it keeps going, what it's going to be like? And I said, They'll start arming the borders and stopping people from leaving the country, and people will be a captive, starving labor force, and the environment will just be gutted. And also, there are plans to build a mega port by El Salvador on the Pacific. There's signs of that if you look at the Alliance for Prosperity, and if you've ever heard of the Model Cities Project, where like these economic disaster zones where the Honduran Constitution doesn't even exist. And also there are signs that of an energy corridor. A lot of these hydroelectric dams are about building an energy corridor to send energy north to the United States, and also oil and gas corridor moving through Honduras north to the United States. So there are big mega schemes here. And in terms of the Honduran people, I said 4 years ago, and they're trapping people with their own country. And you can see that now. U.S. is funding Honduran border security, stopping people from leaving their own country. This is our tax dollars are paying for this. And even some seemingly liberal groups like Washington Office on Latin America, which is actually really bad on Honduras and as good on other countries, they even tweeted saying, well, Trump, if you want to stop immigration, like, don't say that we should cut money for border security and policing in Honduras. I mean, like, well, even endorse that. U.S. funded the Honduran Border Patrol that hunts down people in the woods, trying to flee their own country. I mean, that's what's going on with dogs, and you can see that. There's pictures on the Honduran paper of, like, dogs having trapped these women and children. So I wish I could say there's like a happy future, but this extractive model at the point of a gun and people aren't allowed to leave. I mean, I think people would not even be paying attention to this if people hadn't gotten out of the country and arrived at our border and somebody decided to call that a crisis. How many people in the room would even be here hearing this story?
I have a question for that.
Yeah, he asked about the policy level. What should the actual policy should be? What's in the Berta Cáceres, but what else should be done? I mean, the cut the police and military aid has been our basic demand, but it goes, those kinds of demands go way back to El Salvador in the 80s. You know, the Berta Cáceres Act is modeled on actual bills from the 80s that we studied when we wrote it. But you can cut the U.S. police and military aid, and it will all keep functioning down there. They get it from other places. They get $200 million for weapons and planes and a ship from Israel, for example. $200 million that was given on loans from Israel within 2 weeks of when the U.S. gave $53 billion to Israel for 10 years. So I'm convinced there's a pay through there, but I don't have any evidence. Money also comes through Colombia. It comes from the EU. It comes from Canada. It comes from Spain. And it comes through the U.S. in ways that we don't know. We certainly do not want to be funding them, right? Or even thinking. It's a way of talking about who are we working with, who are those security forces, who's in charge of them. In many ways, it's a symbolic thing, but it's also very, very real. Because if it wasn't so real, why doesn't everybody support it, right? But and the bill also says vote no on all future multilateral development banks, because that's where the big money is for security forces. That's where the money comes in. Then there's the military cooperation. Like the Marines are down there doing exercise. The Southern Command is down there. There are 600 permanent troops at Sotocano Air Force Base. What are they doing there? Who is the enemy in this story, right? Who are we fighting? I always say two things. Listen to the Hondurans. There's this convergence of against continuity, which includes Luis Zelaya right now. It includes Nasrallah, the opposition nutcase candidate who won the election. It includes Libre. It includes all the human rights groups. It includes the Lenca people, organization COPIN. It includes the Jesuits. You name it. And they say that Juan Orlando should be resigned. There should be a permanent government reflecting these people and a constitutional convention. And it's very amazing that that coalition is getting so far across the spectrum. I try to listen to what they say, not say what I want to come up with a scheme. And the other thing is a lot of the work I do and my friends do is to do what do we do to help the Hondurans stay alive to fight another day to see what they want. So we did a lot to try to keep Berta Cáceres alive. The most outspoken congressperson of the opposition, Maria Elisa Borjas, was the person who wrote the report that the former police director was a death squad leader. She was just charged with character defamation by one of the richest men in the country, and she was just convicted. She could go to jail. If she goes to jail, they will have silenced one of the biggest voices, critical voices in the Congress and in the country. And if she goes to jail and can't pay a fine instead, they'll kill her in jail. I mean, the police, she's the biggest critic of the police, and they control the jails. So there's also this other sphere of what do we do to keep them alive with solidarity so that they can then have the space to have their own definitions of what democracy looks like to them. And the tendency is to spend money on programs. And somebody in Congress taught me this years ago, the distinction between policy and programs. The policy is support Juan Orlando. And then you say, okay, let's give them a lot of money through USAID for this and this and this program where you have a government that's destroying the economy, destroying the state, stealing the covered vine, and they're drug traffickers and working with the gangs, right? So, like, what are we doing? Giving them even more money to fix the economy. And, of course, we want to fix the economy, but it shouldn't be up to us to decide how that economy gets fixed. They have all kinds of visions. And also, the beautiful stuff I want to say, I've met people working with asylum cases, working on sanctuary. This isn't in terms of changing the policy, but if you want to learn about this, you can go and be supportive of people seeking asylum that are in detention or in desperate need of someone to be able to look out for them and talk to them. And they will tell you their stories of why they're leaving better than I can. I'm only speaking on their behalf and listen to their stories. And so I've been doing a couple expert witnesses in Honduran asylum cases, and it's taught me so much about the immigration court system, but also why those people are fleeing, but also seeking asylum is itself a political act, especially in our current context, right? But also this amazing, beautiful activism that's going on in the United States and 22-year-old ferocious generation of young people that has been very inspiring for me.
That was Dana Frank on Honduras, coups, crises, and caravans. She spoke at the University of Denver. Dana Frank is Professor of History Emerita at the University of California at Santa Cruz. She's the author of several books, including The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and U.S. Policy in the Aftermath of the Coup. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such progressive voices as Ralph Nader, Arturo Vargas, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Tim Butler recorded the program. Special thanks to the Latin American Center at the University of Denver. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. steps forward, five steps back.